Hi, this is Austin Hill. Hey, thanks for listening to this highlight from Austin Hill in the Morning. Now, remember, to hear the entire broadcast or more highlights from our recent episodes, you can go to the Austin Hill in the Morning program page on our mobile-friendly website, myfaithradio.com. Thanks for listening. Good morning. It's now 7:36 Central Time from the Faith Radio Network. I am Austin Hill, honored to be with you weekday mornings 6 till 8 as we seek to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful here at the start of your day. Who am I? What's my real, true identity? What's the meaning of life? What is the purpose of our human existence? What lies ahead for all of us in death? Those kinds of questions are often described as existential questions, questions that really get to the core of what it is to be human or not to be human. They're pretty far-reaching and pretty deep questions. My next guest, who's really no guest at all, he's no stranger, certainly. He's authored a book called Grand Central Question. He also speaks with the Ravi Zacharias International Ministry on these and other important subjects. Raised in Islam, today he is an evangelical Christian and a Christian apologist, and he's actually been on the program before and has said that group identities and ideologies and philosophies like radical Islam tend to try and address those deep questions, sometimes better than the church does. Abdu Murray joins us on our guest line once again here on Faith Radio to talk further. Abdu, welcome back to the program. Good to talk to you.
Awesome. It's a pleasure. Good to talk to you, too.
Existential questions, the deep questions about the meaning of our lives. You've said before that radical Islam and other worldviews, other philosophies, seek to address those issues, while sometimes the church skirts the issue. Tell us about that.
Oh, sure. These are all four of these questions are what I call, you know, the fundamental questions, and each one of our worldviews is trying to answer them. In fact, if any worldview doesn't answer all four questions and doesn't answer all four questions not only comprehensively but coherently, then that worldview really, you know, shouldn't have our allegiance. It's just some thoughts that are put together randomly. And surprisingly enough, even the most developed systems, religious systems, and even non-religious systems, try to answer all four. But it's been my contention as I've seen these different ones that they haven't really answered all four in a cohesive way. Now, I think that that there are churches out there that are doing a great job of trying to espouse and tell us these worldviews, but for the most part, and it will answer these questions, but for the most part, we're not focusing on all four questions. And that's unfortunate because I think the church has the message that answers all four questions. You know, how do we get here? Why are we here? Why is here the way it is? And how do we get out of here, so to speak? We have the answers to those questions, and we have the best answers. And I think that those answers are the ones we can offer to our, especially to our non-Christian friends.
How does the worldview of atheism offer an appealing answer to any of those questions? I mean, and I say this realizing that right here where our network is headquartered in the Twin Cities, we have a very robust atheist society, atheist advocacy groups in the state of Minnesota and here in the Twin Cities, and they're proliferating all over the country. But what is the appeal of atheism with these deep questions?
Well, I'm not... The appeal, there's two parts of it. There's the answers they give, and then there's the appeal to the answers they give. I think part of the appeal is based in the human need for autonomy, the human need to sort of like define our own destinies and these kind of things and figure out who we are on our own and, you know, we're sort of the masters of our own little universe. I think that's the appeal. But the problem is that there is a... For example, in secular humanism is really the worldview face of atheism. Most atheists are secular humanists, though not all of them are, and it certainly is the case that most humanists are atheists. When you look at what the worldview of secular humanism actually is, you can get it right from the name, secular humanism. Humanism is the idea that human beings have essential value and objective value. But secular, we don't need God to tell us that, that somehow we just have this value. And if you look at all the creeds and manifestos and various statements by atheist organizations, they'll tell you that there is a need for a shared collective of morality, and we discover these things ourselves. But every human being is valuable and has an essential dignity and worth. In the book, what I try to point out is that's a statement that I affirm, too. and that every Christian can affirm. Yes, we all have essential value in intrinsic worth.
I was just thinking that. Yes, go ahead.
But you need a objective moral standard to make that claim. I'm very happy that atheists are moral people. I'm very happy that they have this moral center. But the problem is that they don't have a grounding, a philosophical grounding, to make that statement. That what they wish was true about human value is only true if there is a God. And in fact, my contention is if there's a God who is the God of the Bible. I mean, when you ask a secular humanist, well, how do we get here? The first two questions, how do we get here and what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
You have to ask, what the point of being here is something that we create. It is a subjective meaning. We don't have an objective purpose, because an objective purpose means a purpose that that happens because, or we, that we have because there is, it doesn't depend on human opinion. Something is objectively true if it doesn't depend on human opinion. And for the atheist, it has to depend on human opinion because we're the only game in town. Sort of the Protagoras statement from days past.
Human beings are the only game in town.
Things.
Right.
Well, the problem with that inherently is that we're bad, historically very bad, at determining human value. Whose value are we talking about? The value of Pol Pot or of Mao Zedong, or the value of Mother Teresa, or, you know, the British Humanist Association.
Mm-hmm.
It's very tough to determine who's right and who's wrong here on an objective basis because there is no objective standard.
Yeah, as
you're
describing,
they want to say it's objective, and so I think you need God for that.
Right, yeah, it would certainly seem that way. Abdu Murray, author of Grand Central Question, he's on our guest line here on Faith Radio. It's intriguing as you spell this out, Abdu, and you say, well, listen, humanists believe in the dignity of all persons, all individual human beings. And yet, in societies like some that you mentioned, the culture that was tyrannized by Pol Pot, or even in Hitler's Germany, for that matter, in societies where God is locked out, so to speak, that are deemed to be secular, you get things like the aborting of the unborn or the slaughter of specific people groups, Jews in the case of the Third Reich. I mean, you get this philosophy that says we're all dignified and we have intrinsic worth, but some are have more intrinsic worth than others if God is not in the picture. I think that's what you're telling us.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, and you see it even working out in our day. It's not just the sort of recent history regimes of third world countries or whatever it might be. You actually have it in our day. Consider the fact, for example, that if this idea that value is not intrinsic just because you're a person. Now, that's an old idea. The Romans didn't give you value just because you were born. That word person comes from Latin meaning persona, meaning mask. It was put on you by someone else. And only after the Christian burst on the scene, only after Christianity burst on the scene, did you see inequality amongst all people, because Jesus says, we're all equally sinners, yet we're all equally redeemable, because we have all equal value in and of ourselves because of the Imago Dei. The problem is that if you don't hold on to that view, what you end up is what modern-day philosophers and ethicists like Peter Singer out of Princeton University, he says and he argues that we don't have value just because we're born. We only have the value that other people place on us. So, for example, he argues that parents should be able to abort or kill their newborn babies up to a certain age, not preborn, mm-hmm. newborn babies. And he's not alone in this. Francesca Minerva and Alberto Giubilini are two medical ethicists out of Australia who make this very same argument, that because babies can't give value to themselves, only the parents can. Parents can murder their children up to a certain age because they don't have value intrinsically, mm-hmm. only what someone else gives them. And that's not a sort of a doomsday, you know, sky is falling kind of a statement. This is actually argued in our medical journals, in our ethics classes in this very country.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, it's happening. It's not a forecast of things to come. It's our present reality. Abdu Murray, author of the book Grand Central Question, breaking it down for us. Why would the secular humanist or atheistic worldview have appeal to people, even suburban kids in America, for that matter? And why would radical Islam have appeal to suburban individuals in the United States, or urban people, for that matter? Why the appeal? And is the church really, truly answering some of these deeper questions that are common among all human beings? We'll talk further with Abdu in just moments. It's now 7:46 Central Time. It's Faith Radio.
back to Austin Hill in the morning. Questions or comments for the show? You can leave them on our show page at myfaithradio.com.
It's 7:48 Central Time from the Faith Radio Network. I am Austin Hill, honored to have you with us weekday morning, 6 till 8. Abdu Murray, author of Grand Central Question. He's also a speaker with the Ravi Zacharias International Ministry. He's on our guest line here on Faith Radio. He's written a very striking piece. We've got it on our website. It's called How Christianity Answers Essential Questions, the deep, what some people would call existential questions of our lives, questions about our existence. Why are we here? What are we supposed to do while we're here? How do we leave this earth? And where do we go in its aftermath? Abdu, you've written that indeed our Christian faith addresses these deeper issues, but you've also said here on the program, in no uncertain terms, that oftentimes churches in our culture, and youth ministry in particular, oftentimes doesn't begin to address these kinds of things. And that creates a vacuum, an emptiness with young people in particular. Tell us more about that.
Oh, sure. Now, I think our churches and our youth programs are doing a fine job in lots of ways. And my goodness, when you think about what churches and pastors have to deal with, how many things they have to deal with, it's no wonder that they sort of flounder in their efforts to try to do their best to answer some of these questions, given the limited time constraints and all the obligations they have.
Sure.
But there is the reality that a lot of these kids, a lot of youth, for example, are asking the toughest questions. I do a lot of speaking at the Q&A sessions. Almost everyone who asks the questions are people who are 25 and younger, and they ask some of the deepest, deepest questions. I've been surprised by the 12-year-olds who have asked sophisticated questions. One of the things that they're not doing, now part of this is because they're not asking their youth pastor because of whatever reasons it might be. Maybe that they're involved in the details or the community aspects of what it means to be in youth ministry. But sometimes they are. And I get a lot of calls from youth pastors who say, can you meet with these folks for me and with me on some of these questions? They're asking the deep existential questions. Sometimes they're afraid to ask. Sometimes they're not asking their parents or their pastors because they either distrust in some way or they feel like if I ask, this might be too hard. And what if they don't have an answer for me?
Mm-hmm.
So they linger in this doubt, not because they haven't asked because there aren't answers. They're just a little afraid that maybe the people who are an authority in my life or who are people who I would trust don't have an answer to the seemingly tough question. The problem is someone's going to answer them. In the age of an internet, where anybody can get to anybody at any time, someone's going to answer these questions for them. And we need to be ready to be able to answer these questions before someone else does, because rest assured, someone else is trying to.
And that's the crux of the issue. Somebody else is trying to. I have to tell you, just briefly, after one of our recent discussions, I believe it was back in November, one day you were on the program here, Abdu Murray, and you had addressed this issue that young people in particular have very deep, thoughtful questions in their souls that don't get answered in the church. And later that afternoon, I was driving home from school through ice and snow. My 16-year-old son and a group of his peers, another teenage young man, age 16, and two young girls, age 16 and 15, respectively. All four of them come from very devout, regular, evangelical church-attending families. I know all the parents. They're great folks. But I just threw out this question. Does the church answer the deeper questions of human existence? And unanimously, all four of the young people, my son included, although my son's answer was a little nuanced, but all three of these young people said, no, the church wants to tell us we just accept things on faith. Don't ask anything further. And that's kind of where the conversation ends. That was a very enlightening experience for me, and it sounds like you experienced that a lot in your speaking engagements with young people.
I do, and you know, it's funny because even people who are seasoned Christians will use that word, faith, and I think sometimes we misunderstand it. We've let the culture, the non-Christian culture, define our terms for us. And in fact, when you look at the way the Bible actually uses the word faith and defines the word faith, you will never see an instance where God asks us to trust him absent any evidence. Every single time he asks us to trust him, it's because he's delivered something that will prove to us that he's worthy of our trust. And of course, he's more than worthy of our trust. And that's because the word faith in the Greek actually means trust. It means active trust. And you see that it's always based on something God has done. The the instances in the Bible over and over again where God says, test me in this, and you'll see that I will do what I said I will do. But he almost always asks us to do that based on what he's already done. And because the Christian faith is so rich in evidence, both scientific and historical and even philosophical and existential, when you're asked to trust God, I trust God to do what he says he will do because of what he already has done and because of the knowledge I have of what he already has done, specifically the creation of the world, and even more specifically, the resurrection from the dead of Jesus.
Well, thanks again for listening to this highlight from Austin Hill in the Morning. Remember, for more information about this, visit the Austin Hill in the Morning program page on our mobile-friendly website, myfaithradio.com.